KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Downtown.
Fruitvale. Out in East Oakland.
I live in Lake Merritt neighborhood.
Coming up, a San Francisco-based federal court argues with the Trump administration over its treatment of migrant children.
If you don't have a toothbrush, if you don't have soap, if you don't have a blanket, it's not safe and sanitary. Well, wouldn't everybody agree to that?
Then an Eritrean life coach tries to reimagine traditional foods.
What do you do to make it stick together? If you get rid of rice, then it's like, okay, tapioca, experimenting with that.
And we hear the experience of Vietnam vets who've been charged with a crime.
The moment we fall to a criminal allegation, we are attacked.
That's coming up today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. Two weeks ago, the Trump administration argued in court that they don't need to provide things like toothbrushes, soap, or beds to the migrant children they're detaining. A few judges on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco had some choice words for them.
If you don't have a toothbrush, if you don't have soap, if you don't have a blanket, it's not safe and sanitary. Well, wouldn't everybody agree to that? Do you agree to that?
There's fair reason to find that those things may be part of safe and sanitary?
No, maybe. Are a part.
This exchange went viral, and it's contributed to a national outcry over the administration's treatment of detained children. At least six children have died in Border Patrol custody since September 2018, and the head of the agency recently resigned. According to KALW's immigration reporter, Teresa Katsarillas, this viral moment also highlights something else: the Ninth Circuit's role in checking Trump's immigration policies. And Teresa joins me now. Hey, Teresa.
Hey, Hannah.
So first off, if you can just remind us, what exactly is the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals?
Right. So the Supreme Court is the most powerful federal court in the U.S. We all know that. But if you go one step below that, the second most powerful courts in the U.S., or in our federal system at least, are these 13 circuit courts that preside over different regions of the country.
Okay.
The Ninth Circuit is the largest of these courts by far. It has appellate jurisdiction over 9 Western states, including California. Over 20 judges currently serve on the court, which in the world of federal courts is a lot. And the court is based right here in San Francisco.
Okay, so why was the Trump administration arguing about toothbrushes in front of the Ninth Circuit?
Right, so this hearing was about the Flores Agreement, which basically sets the standards for how the federal government treats the migrant children it detains. The agreement was reached during the Clinton administration, and it says children must be held in, quote, safe and sanitary conditions.
Okay.
Now, attorneys have argued for years that Flores wasn't being enforced, and they filed a motion to that effect during the Obama years. So fast forward to 2017, a federal judge ordered Border Control to appoint a monitor and make sure detained children get things like dry clothes and a real bed. The Trump administration says that the judge's ruling went way beyond the Flores Agreement, and it argues that children don't need dry clothes or beds to be, quote, safe and sanitary.
That really happened?
Yes, it did. It is all on tape.
All right. So the Ninth Circuit sounded pretty skeptical of that argument.
Right. They haven't ruled on this case yet, but they certainly don't sound inclined to rule in the Trump administration's favor on this. I should note that the judge you heard at the top of this story, Judge Tashima, he's Japanese-American, and he was interned as a child. And so that added a certain amount of emotional weight to that heated exchange.
Mm-hmm. And this wouldn't be the first time they ruled against the Trump administration.
It would not. So the Ninth Circuit is somewhat more progressive than the other circuit courts. And by the way, that's not because it's based in San Francisco, though you might hear people say that. It's because many of its judges were appointed by Obama and Clinton, even Carter. There's still a few of them around.
Mm-hmm.
And while the court has ruled in the Trump administration's favor several times, like you might have heard of the Remain in Mexico policy,
right.
Ninth Circuit did rule in the Trump administration's favor on that.
Right.
However, by and large, they've played a really key key role in blocking some of Trump's most well-known immigration policies.
Muslim ban.
Muslim ban, yeah. Mm. So, you know, I'm sure we all remember that Trump rolled out his travel ban against six majority Muslim countries right after taking office. There was that chaotic week when it was in effect, and then it just went away for a while. That's because it was blocked by lower-level courts, and then the Ninth Circuit kept ruling it was illegal. They actually ruled it was illegal three different times. Wow. I should note that the Supreme Court did eventually allow it. It is in effect, but the Ninth Circuit delayed it. And here's another one. Remember Trump's asylum ban in 2018? Yeah, yeah, okay. So the asylum ban, for just a refresher course, he issued a proclamation that would bar immigrants from seeking asylum if they initially crossed the border illegally. This was around the time that people were talking about the migrant caravan.
Zero tolerance,
mm-hmm. Exactly, zero tolerance. Well, that policy never went into effect because, once again, it was also blocked by a lower-level court. Ninth Circuit ruled against the Trump administration. There are a lot of examples of this. Ninth Circuit ruled against Trump when he tried to end DACA, when he tried to defund sanctuary cities. They've done it again and again.
Right. So what has been the Trump's administration reaction to these rulings?
So let's just say that Trump has been very vocal about how unhappy he has been with this court. Mm-hmm. He has tweeted about this extensively. Mm. The Ninth Circuit is also ridiculed by members of the right-wing media. Uh-huh. Rush Limbaugh has called it the Ninth Circus. Mm. Newt Gingrich has called for the court to be abolished. And the Trump administration is trying to pack the court in their favor.
How? How are they planning to do that?
Well, by appointing new judges. So uh-huh. there are several vacancies on the Ninth Circuit, and the Trump administration is busy appointing judges to those positions. In May, the U.S. Senate approved conservative Judge Daniel Collins' appointment to the bench over Democratic legislators' objections, including Democratic senators from California. 16 of the Ninth Circuit judges were appointed by Democratic presidents, but 11 spots are currently being filled by the Republicans, and Trump has two vacancies left to fill. Conservatives, I should mention, have also flirted with just adding more judges to the court in general, mm-hmm. bringing the total number of the Ninth Circuit judges to 34 so that you could skew the entire court conservative. But I will say legal experts think that that's unlikely to happen.
Sounds like it's a big thorn in the side of the Trump administration.
It sure is.
Okay. Teresa, thank you.
Thank you, Hannah.
Teresa is KALW's immigration reporter. You can reach her at immigration@kalw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Oakland resident Tigisti Weldiab was a child when she fled the Eritrean-Ethiopian War with her mom. They lived in refugee camps for years, and during that time, her mom made a living by selling injera, their traditional flatbread. A decade later, they were settled in the U.S. Tigisti went to school, landed a solid job in the energy industry. They did well. Then her mom got diabetes, and Tigisti knew something had to change about the way they and their community ate in this new land. People were making traditional stews and injera with American ingredients, and something was just not working. Today, Tigisti is a nutritionist and wellness influencer and health coach working with Oakland's Eritrean community to reimagine recipes from home with new ingredients in a way that keeps everybody healthy. I visited Tigisti in her kitchen where she told me her story while making a lentil stew called addis.
So I'm cutting onions. And we're going to saute some onions and tomatoes and garlic. And we're going to make a simple lentil stew that is eaten by majority of Eritreans and Sudanese, probably most East Africans. Traditionally, we probably don't use olive oil, probably like palm oil or canola. But I've switched to olive oil because it's healthier, and sometimes I use avocado oil. So the onion is still sauteing. And maybe in about a minute, we're going to put my olive oil. I don't measure. So if I had to guess, I probably would say it's like 2 tablespoons. Maybe 3.
So while you're doing your garlic, yes, and checking our pot to see about the onions, talk about where you were born, where you kind of grew up, and your path in your childhood and your teenage years.
Oh boy, where do we start? So yeah, my mom is a central part of this conversation. I was born in Eritrea, obviously, but I don't have much memory of Eritrea. I was probably almost 3 when we escaped. In the middle of the night in 1982, early 1982, to Sudan. She was married off at age 14 and had her first child by 16, never educated, never sent to school. She gets married off to my dad. And the next thing you know, at age 26, she's abandoned in a strange country with 4 kids, and she cannot read or write. So I think she's had to be kind of superhuman strong. So my mother decides, I'm not going to go work in an office because I don't have any education, and I'm now going to have to go and provide like the husband is supposed to do. So she decides to do the only thing she knew how to do at that time, which is to go and sell injera. Injera is what is rice to like a lot of Asian cultures and what is tortilla to like South America or Mexico, because it operates both at a staple like a bread or rice, but also as a utensil, because you grab injera and you wrap the food with it because we eat with our hands. So she woke up one day at dawn. Because many years after that, that's what she did. Wake up in the middle of the night, sometimes 4 or 5 in the morning, made injera and went out into the market and start selling injera. It is a staple in a real sense because you need it to scoop up the food. And it is what people eat back home when they don't have all the luxuries like bread and milk and honey and whatever, all the stuff that is hard to get. So, but injera is present and it's there to keep people alive. And it's been around for centuries.
And then people migrate.
And people migrate. And then it becomes a choice. I don't have to eat injera to survive. I have a lot of options. I also have forks and spoons. But whenever I want to feel a connection to home, a connection to my mom, a connection to my roots, whenever I'm entertained and whenever I have guests, I instantly default to injera because it's my way of connecting.
You decided to do business. You were doing really well, but something made you stop, mm-hmm, and pause,
yeah,
and switch your whole career.
Yeah, so this was when I was going about my life and just focusing on career advancement and stuff. Then my mother gets diagnosed with diabetes, which, you know, I think it's not a diet situation. I think that, or maybe a little bit because we like sugar. She drinks coffee, sugar. But other than that, I think stress is a big factor. And my mom has a lot of things that she suppressed from a long time. So I think it manifested itself in high blood pressure and stress. And she was so young at the time. I think she was like in her early 50s.
Did food have to change in the household, or like our foods from back,
yeah,
home are so saucy, salty,
yes, yeah,
carby.
Yeah.
You know, there's some protein in there, which is great, but there's just like all of this other stuff.
No, I don't think you can convince an African for food to change. And I'm just being honest, because food is so central to our identity. So what you do is that you teach modification.
getting her to drink coffee without sugar, which is hard probably the first week, but only maybe using sugar when you have guests as opposed to every day, which she drinks coffee every day. You know, then thinking about when you make injera, what do you make it with? Completely get rid of self-rising, which is horrible. So then, you know.
Self-rising flour?
Yeah, self-rising that makes it kind of rise. That is one of the worst things you can put in your bread making / injera. Anything, you know, carby, it's horrible. So then figuring out what can you sell. Now it's like a lot of people are catching on to this, but back then it was like, what? You want me to give up what? So figuring out what do you do to make it rise, or what do you do to make it stick together if you get rid of rice? You know, because I don't want her to use white rice. Then it's like, okay, tapioca, let's use that, experimenting with that. And then also to get her to cook without butter. Ghee, sometimes, you know, the spice butter is hard to give up. So it's like one of the hardest was transitioning her to olive oil and then working through that resistance.
How did your mom do with that process?
Surprisingly, good. And I think it's because for her, just having to adapt comes much easier. Everywhere she went, she's had to adjust to something, adapt, evolve. So when they told her, you're going to either change that or inject yourself on a daily basis, guess what? You're going to choose not to be injecting yourself. So yeah, buy butter.
Your workshops with the Eritrean community, what message do you think did get through and what message do you think people are struggling with?
Yeah, I think that the message that is always well received is that when it comes to their kids, it's like even if something they consider is impossible, when you tell them that possibly what it could be doing to their kids physically, mentally, they're like, oh my God. So they just want to go home and throw something out immediately. But then not as much when it comes to theirs. It's to their own bodies or whatever, which is weird because I think part of it is just culturally we're expected to think of others first and dedicate, especially mothers. They think of their kids and their husbands, but never of themselves. So they don't think they are a priority. Or what has been less received a lot of times is that when I preach self-care, and when I tell them, like, a lot of these moms are burned out and they're like working full-time, but also working full-time at home while the husband is chilling. So when I try to convince them, like, why do you have two jobs? And, you know, it's you who has to demand, you know, equality, you know, more, you know, division of labor. And it's like, I might as well, they look at me like they saw an alien. Like, you want me to ask for what? Like, how? So that is really sad a lot of times for me because they just take on so much.
Okay. Now we can go back to the kitchen.
All right, let's do it.
Let's see what's up with the pot.
Yes, so it was just simmering, so it's probably done.
So I just put in the garlic, and I'm going to put the spices. Some garlic salt, a little bit of salt, a little bit of cumin. It's one of my favorite spices. And I'm going to bring a little bit of ginger that my mom dried and grinded for me. So let it simmer for 5 more minutes and it's done. Most people, what they do is you either have like a side of greens, like usually lettuce with tomato, a little bit of onion and salt real quick as a side dish and you're good to go. Lovely. And shy.
And shy.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
We've got some pictures of Tagisti with her lentil stew at klw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Henat Baba. Next up, we've got a story from Uncuffed, our series recorded and edited by incarcerated men at Solano State Prison in Vacaville.
This is Uncuffed.
Stories from Solano State Prison.
The 4th of July is coming up, and it's a good time to think about how we treat our veterans. Uncuffed producer Steve Drown served during the Vietnam War. Now he's doing time at Solano State Prison. Here's Steve.
I've known Mark Richards for about 6 years. We've had a number of discussions about the treatment and needs of returning vets, both now and during Vietnam, when we both served. The differences between these two periods is extreme, yet at the same time, some things never change.
I came up with a draft number of 11.
Wow.
So there was no chance of me not going somewhere, so I enlisted. And I went in as a 90-day wonder.
Explain for the listeners who may not understand what a 90-day wonder is.
When our country's at war, they rush a lot of the educational and training systems. Within 90 days, you did your boot, you did command training.
We both served during the same period of time that I did not go in country. I was part of a training command here in the States. But I think we both, if not experienced directly, saw the reaction of the public to veterans, to people coming back from Nam at that time. What can you share about what you saw?
Well, it wasn't friendly. I think sometimes we forget as time passes that they've made quite a deal out of how wonderful things were when the men came back from World War II. We saw, obviously, an entirely different and very negative response.
You were very fortunate in when you did come home because you flew into Travis. What happened when you drove outside the gate?
Well, at the time, in those days, they had pickets. They had people protesting at the gates. We got hit by bags full of manure.
We look at society now and how they react to veterans today. We watch a football game, we watch a baseball game, and one of the first things they do is, all the veterans in the arena, please stand, and they're acknowledged. We wouldn't have seen that. And you said, I think it's wonderful, but I don't trust it. Is it the modern day reaction to veterans?
Yeah, I don't trust it. Vets that are coming back, just a mess. And yet you have to question, if you care about them, why aren't you organizing the PTSD groups and the psychological help that the men need from the start? It's a little late to be patching up our wounds when we get back if you aren't taking care of the mental stress.
You see these things about the wounded vets, the ones that lost limbs, whatever it was.
Look at the suicide rate.
Right. PTSD. When we both served, it wasn't even a term you heard. You didn't even know what it was. I think it's kind of strange that now we find ourselves incarcerated, yet we seem to be getting more opportunities to address PTSD issues than we ever did before.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
And you've been a very integral part of that.
I realize that there are varying degrees of this problem. One of the prouder things that I've done over the last few years, actually, has been my efforts and all of our efforts to set up groups. We've finally gotten a excellent PTSD group going here for the men, and I honestly think, I know it's helped me.
Are you proud of your service?
Yes, absolutely.
If you were physically able and they called, would you do it again?
Absolutely. A number of us have volunteered several times.
You and I are pretty well close to the same age, almost 70. We were in our 20s when we served. When do you think your time as a vet has actually been appreciated?
Unfortunately, I don't think for myself people would ever appreciate it. The moment we fall to a criminal allegation, we are attacked, and we are attacked for our veterans' backs.
Right. As you very well know, there's portion of my record during my military service, and I know there's portions of yours that are, in all intents and purposes, sealed.
Right.
The courts can't see them.
Right.
And the courts do not like that.
No.
Because they automatically question what we were doing.
It puts you on a front burner that the public doesn't understand that is used against men. Mm. My point is always, don't blame it on my military career.
I would have considered it an honor to have served with you.
Oh, thank you.
From one veteran to another, thank you for your service.
Thank you.
That's Mark Richards speaking with Steve Drown. Steve is a producer in KALW's radio program at Solano State Prison. It's supported by the California Arts Council and the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. The producers fact-check content to the best of their ability, and all content is approved by an information officer. You can listen to more stories from Uncuffed at klw.org/uncuffed. And make sure you're subscribed to the Cross Currents podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Get all the stories and interviews wherever you want, whenever you want. This music is by Aviva LaFay from Oakland. She's playing at the Starline Social Club tomorrow night. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.
Across seven seas, waiting for you. I know.